You're listening to Choose FI Radio. The blueprint for financial independence lives here. If you're looking to unlock the secrets to financial independence and early retirement, you're in the right place. Stay tuned and join a community of like-minded people who are getting off the hamster wheel and taking control of their lives in the pursuit of financial independence. Choose FI, your home for financial independence online.
All right, guys, super excited to dive into this week's episode. We are going to be speaking with Nick True from mappedoutmoney.com. And I think the reason I want to hit this episode and the reason I want to continue to highlight episodes like this is financial independence is not a binary equation where on the one end you find out about it and then 10 to 15 years you reach financial independence. This is a spectrum where from the moment that you discover the concept, your worldview is forever changed. And this is a life optimization strategy where you continue to see the control come to your side of the equation. Honestly, Nick's story is the perfect example of this, and it's going to be such a source of encouragement to our community and to our audience, people that are on the path. Very excited about this episode. And to help me with this, I have my co-host Brad here with me today. How you doing, buddy?
Hey, Jonathan, I'm doing quite well. And yeah, we had the good fortune of meeting Nick down in Florida this year at Camp Phi, and just a really interesting guy, gave an amazing presentation, and we knew immediately that we needed to have him on the show for sure. And to your point, it's not binary. And I think Nick is going to show that perfectly. He's also going to talk about what financial health means to him. I read a bunch of his articles and I was just blown away. So with that, Nick, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks so much for having me, guys. I am ecstatic to be on here with you.
So Nick, I think for our audience, a great place to start would be just give us a sense of what your life looks like now. Like, what are you and your wife doing?
So right this minute, we are currently in Northeast Alabama, and we live in a 2007 27-foot Airstream travel trailer. We moved into this about a couple years ago, and it's me, my wife, and we have two cats and two dogs that live in here with us. That's kind of our living situation. And then we have, you know, over the course of the last couple of years, transitioned to working remotely so that we can travel. And then for us, also a big priority is being around family and being able to go and travel and see them whenever we want.
And Nick, you're in your mid-20s, right? So this is not like I've been working an entire career and then we decided to get up and do this, right? As I understand it, you're like around 25?
Yes, that's exactly right. And it was kind of funny, Brad. Actually, I did not quit my day job to fire, but when I did quit to go move into an Airstream, there were some disgruntled folks at my old job because that was also their dream, was to retire and move into an RV. So it was a little funny when I was, you know, figuring out how to do that in my mid-20s.
Wow. So their dream. I mean, is this something you actually talked about with them or did you find out after the fact? I mean, were financial conversations ever a part of your job?
There was one guy that I worked very closely with, and we talked a lot about finance because over the course of the years, he just kind of learned that I was really into it, but I couldn't let everybody know my game plan because I needed the job for a while. There was another guy in our group who was in his late 50s and had bought an RV during the last year that I was working there. Around the same time, I actually bought my camper. He was talking about it at work every single day because he was retiring at the end of the year and all these big RV trips. I could not talk to him about what I was doing until the very end. It made it for an interesting daily environment at work.
Okay, so just to clarify, have you reached financial independence?
No, we have not. Okay. And we're still probably a good ways from it.
All right, so I just want to put myself in the shoes of a listener, like maybe even myself. Oh man, one of these days, once I'm at the point where I don't need to worry about money anymore, I want to go travel around the country. I want to be freed up to go on these adventures. I want to do. I have this list. But you just did it.
Yes. It seems weird. We basically looked at what was going on in the world and said, hey, look, it's 2017 at the time, 2018. There's this thing called the internet, and we could figure out a way to work remotely. And then we could go and travel and do some of these things now before we have kids and before we really get ourselves into a situation where traveling full time would be extremely difficult.
All right. So, you know, I'm having this conversation with you and I'm positive that this is not one of these, hey, I'm going to go live in a van down by the river, motivational speaker. It's all going to be great. Like, I suspect that you guys did this in a financially responsible way and one that will be inspirational to our audience. Like, help me reverse engineer this. How is this possible?
Yeah, so for us, some of the key highlights, and we can dive deep on any one of these points, but for us, some of the key highlights were we were able to get through college without any debt. We had no other debt in our names at all. We both got married really young, and we're both extremely driven. And so we had been married for a few years at this point. We had gotten used to working together as a team, and one day we found out that there was this possibility of traveling full-time. And at the time, my wife was a physical therapist. And so the way that we initially got into the travel life was that she took a job as a travel physical therapist, which means she worked for a travel agency that would place her in hospitals for 3 months at a time. In the meantime, I started building up a freelance business on the side of my day job so that we could eventually do that full time and work 100% remotely. So the way we initially got into the travel life was literally just transitioning our full time income to a way that allows us to do it remotely. And then once we were able to do that, well, then it doesn't matter if we live in Tennessee or an RV or wherever we live. As long as we can get internet access, that was kind of our main driver.
And you do have every possibility in the world then, right? Of where do you want to live? How do you want to live, et cetera? How did you guys pick an Airstream trailer? Was this a dream of yours and your wife's for years and years? Like, I mean, how do you settle on that?
Yeah. So we are both really into like outdoors and travel and seeing new places. Our very first date, we went on a hike and then went swimming at this Blue Hole area up in Tennessee. Like we're both kind of geared that way. And so the camping life was always really appealing to us. And then when we finally started looking at specific RVs, we had four pets. We knew we didn't want something that drove itself in case the engine broke down. Then all of a sudden we were needing to find a hotel room for us and the pets. So we quickly settled on towing whatever it was we were going to get. And then honestly, the route that we went with the Airstream was partly a financial choice in terms of they hold their value, and then partly purely just because those are the ones we love and made financial sense and we were able to afford it. And so that's what we went with.
So we were able to afford it. There's like several pieces to your financial story that I want to explore a little bit with a little bit more closely, just so our audience understands. The first one is going back before the Airstream. College. You said that you and your wife graduated debt free. I mean, I'm not totally in one of these situations where it's like, how is that possible? But I think at the same time, what I'm asking is, how is that possible? Right? Is there anything there for our audience?
Yeah. So, you know, I do want to be upfront and say, you know, both my wife and I are extremely blessed in terms of our parents, and we just grew up in good homes that gave us a lot of wisdom and gave us a lot of, I would say, just like help from a parenting standpoint and raising us to both extremely value hard work and how that translates to success in school and success with finance later on. My wife and I both got a little bit of kickstart, but it was very minuscule as we were heading into college because we both ended up with full rides. And then I was actually able to get $30,000 in scholarships over and above the cost of college that went directly into my bank account over the course of those 4 years.
Going to college for profit. It's a winning strategy.
That's exactly right. I recommend if you're going to go to college, try to go for profit if at all possible. As far as actionable takeaways, you know, for the readers or for the listeners, the main things we did that helped us was we worked our absolute faces off in high school before we even knew each other. Both of us came out of high school with stellar grades.
Is that a 4.0, 4.5? Like, what does stellar grades mean?
Yeah, 4.0 for both our high schools.
Okay.
And then we both chose the same exact college. Again, we met in college, so we didn't know each other, but it was a low-cost in-state school. So
which college was this?
The University of Tennessee at Chattanooga. So it's like a sister school to the University of Tennessee. So it's a very small kind of local state school, like 12,000 students. And we both got into their honors program there, which had quote unquote a full ride. Now, in addition to that, what a lot of people don't know is that once you get into college, especially if you're in the STEM fields and a handful of others, so I majored in mechanical engineering, there are scholarships available at every single year. And the vast majority of people either don't know about them or don't apply for them. It's funny, like, guys, I was applying for 20 to 30 scholarships every single winter break because almost all the dates were due in January and February. So over break, when all my friends were chilling, I was writing essays for new scholarships. I was trying to get my friends to apply for them. Like, I wasn't hoarding. Like, I was telling all my buddies who were making good grades, like, hey, you should apply for this. Hey, you should apply for this. And there were a couple scholarships that I got that they were giving away four, and there were like three of us who applied. So that's what I did. I applied for 20 to 30 scholarships every single year. And then I maintained killer grades in college as well. Now, my wife, on the other hand, going back to us both being strategic, she chose UTC in part because of the low state in school, but also in part because they had a graduate program in physical therapy, which is what she was going for. And so she made a conscious decision that she's going to go to undergrad at the same place that she wanted to go to grad school. And what that allowed her to do was to get in really good with the professors, land an assistantship during her undergrad. And that assistantship was able to be carried over through graduate school because she was awesome and the best assistant they had ever had. And that covered half of her graduate school. And then when I made the 30 grand over and above my undergrad, we were able to take that money and pay cash for the rest of her grad school. So that's kind of how we were able to make it through.
That is amazing. So you took that 30 grand and basically she walked away with her master's and ready to be a physical therapist. You had your undergrad paid for. So that's a master's and two undergrad degrees for $0 in debt, right?
That's exactly right.
That's amazing. So just real quick, you guys got full merit scholarships. You were in the honors program at a state school. Like, I assume, therefore, that would translate to, okay, we did really well in high school. We possibly could have gotten into Ivy Leagues or other elite schools. Was the allure ever there for you? Or like I'm trying to put myself in someone's shoes of like, how do you make that really rational decision as a 17-year-old to, okay, I'm going to go to the local state school. That's not even the flagship state school, right? But the local state school for a full ride and no debt. How were you smart enough at 17 to know to do that?
Yeah, it's a great question. So this is where I go back to what I said at the beginning, which is where we're very blessed in terms of parents who gave us a lot of wisdom. I was the first guy in all of my dad's family to go to college. My dad didn't go to college. He's a successful businessman. So in my home, college was important, but it was important so far as you don't go in debt and you go and make a good business decision in terms of you get a degree that's going to lead to a good job. That was how I was raised. My wife grew up in a very similar setup. Her parents both did go to college, but they even still had those values of you make a wise decision in what you major in, you don't go into debt. They taught us a lot of wise things that really set us up to make those kinds of decisions.
I have a question for you about the scholarships and specifically about the essays that you wrote. There's this little nagging voice in the back of my head that says, oh, I could never write anything that would let me stand out for these scholarships. And I just am thinking in my mind that maybe there's someone in our audience who reflects that thought, I admit it's a limiting belief, but it's there. Did you feel that? Did you just write anyways? Did you come up with a system? Did you strategize how to go about it? Like, when it comes to actually writing an essay that you know is basically the only thing that's going to decide whether or not you get the scholarship, that at the end of the day, the compilation effect was worth close to $30,000. Do you have anything to impart to us specifically on the essay writing process?
Yeah, that's huge. I felt the same way. I'm not a great writer. It's not my strong suit. I'm a math guy, you know, hardcore left brain. And I felt the same way. I struggled with those essays. It was not at all my strength. As far as practical, I'll give you a couple things. Number one is just simply not giving up. So that first year, I don't think I landed, if I remember correctly, I don't know that I landed a single extra scholarship my first year, but I reapplied the next year. And a lot of these scholarships were the same scholarships and that I just applied for every single year. And one scholarship in particular, I applied 3 times and never got it. And my senior year, it was the same essay prompt every single time. My senior year, I won the top national placement for that scholarship. And that scholarship equated for $15,000 and a trip to their conference. And so one is just simply not giving up and putting your head down and getting after it. The second thing is, as far as practical, what I tried to do is I tried to come up with a story bank of ideas and stories from my personal life from both high school and college, be it projects that I worked on, things that I did on the side, either extracurricular. I grew up working for my dad's business. So sometimes I would work in anecdotal stories around like growing up and values that taught me and then values that I was going to carry over into my career. Because almost all these scholarships are centered around, okay, well, what are you going to do for the profession? What are you going to do with your career after this is all said and done and you get out of college? I would work in either moments from my college experience at that point or moments from my childhood and talk about how those kind of things were going to, you know, help me build a career that was going to go on to further X, Y, or Z. Ultimately, it's like anything else. You have to learn what it is that these scholarship people want to hear and then deliver it to them.
Wow, dude, there's so much value there. I hope our audience listens to that and then puts it on repeat for their kids that are either going to college. And what I heard is grit, man. Like, get rid of the limiting beliefs, focus on grit, and just continually get better at this process. It's iterative. The results that you had was frankly because you didn't give up. You just kept reapplying. Half of your results were baked into grit. So a lot there. I appreciate you sharing with us. The next piece that I want to focus on in terms of this college is this concept that was first introduced to me by Robert Farrington, who writes over at The College Investor. And he said verbatim, our generation, speaking about millennials, are the most overeducated, underexperienced generation in history. And the reason I bring that up is because what it comes down to in many cases is not so much the college degree as it is the first job, getting that first job. And I'm curious, for you going from college to that first job, was there any lessons that you learned along the way that you could impart to our audience?
Definitely. So the number one thing that I say to people in college is to make sure you work your entire time in college. I stand by that belief. There was only one semester that I didn't have some sort of income source where I was working. Now, for me, again, going back to my raising, my parents really valued hard work. So I was working from a very, very young age and had all kinds of jobs growing up and all kinds of ways that I was making money. And then in college, I landed a small internship my sophomore year. And that internship was good experience because it taught me exactly what I did not want to be doing. It was a certain type of engineering where you're very isolated, and I'm a very extroverted person. And I was like holed up in a room by myself all day, and that was no good. But I was happy for that experience because it showed me what I didn't need to be doing. After that, I left that internship and I applied for a ton of internships, just like scholarships. I applied for a ton and I was able to get one that was very close to my college. And that internship ended up working out very well. And I worked that job until I graduated. And then I ended up taking a full-time job with that same company right after college. So I'm a huge believer in internships, working throughout college and trying to set yourself up in the industry that you want to be in after college, or even at very least something tangentially related so that you can ease into a job.
I'm going to do the exact same thing with the internships that we did with the scholarships. Like, let's slow down on that. So many people are in college and then they go to apply for the internships and they realize that they have just waited too late. They just weren't aware of the timing. They're doing the research too late. They're behind the eight ball and everything just kind of gets kicked back. And then it's a lackluster effort. Knowing what you know now and having gone through the application process, what does it look like to do this perfectly, to go into college with a game plan? I am going to get an internship. This is how I'm going to prepare myself for that. Do you have any thoughts on that?
I mean, honestly, the best two things I think that worked for me is, number one, becoming a fantastic student, both from a grade standpoint and more importantly, from a relationship building standpoint with the professors. And I think that's a part that a lot of people overlook. I built a really good relationship, especially with a handful of my professors, which allowed me to both get really nice recommendations when I needed them for internships. And it also allowed me to get inside information from like what companies might be hiring. Because a lot of those professors have connections with companies, especially in the area. And they'll say, hey, do you know about so-and-so is actually looking for an intern? They were asking me if I had any good students who I would recommend, and your name came to mind. Would you be interested in that? So that is the way number one, just being a great student and becoming, you know, in with the professors. And then way number two is just simply, it's a numbers game. To me, it was just like the scholarships. I went to our college website, had a list of all the companies in the area for each major. They would kind of aggregate different companies that were hiring, and you could go online and look, or you could just go to the job fair and walk around and take every single paper from every single company that was offering an internship. And that's what I did. And then I just filled out all of them. Just like the scholarship
application. How many did you fill out? All of them, obviously.
Company in the world.
Because I lived on campus, every company that was within like a reasonable distance, being able to make it back and forth from class to school was fair game as far as I was concerned.
Hey, Nick, we talk a lot here at Choose a Vi about building relationships. And obviously you just talked about, I think you said, quote, becoming in with the professors. For many kids at college, they're 18, 19, 20 years old. They don't know how to approach a professor. Like, they don't know how to build a relationship. I'm curious if you can think back and just pass along any tips. Like, how did you, just one student out of thousands, really establish these relationships?
Have you seen his beard, Brad? I mean, like,
yeah, that helps a lot.
Be memorable.
Yeah. I read a book during my freshman year called How to Win Friends and Influence People by Dale Carnegie. And that book has probably had some of the biggest impact on my life in terms of just understanding what makes people tick and how to befriend people. Now, This is not some sort of sleazy, oh, you befriend people to get something out of them. This is legitimate befriending people because you want to make friends. But one of the things that book talks about is having genuine interest in what others are doing. And the key word there is genuine. So what I would try and do is I didn't go to every single professor. If I didn't feel like I was going to click with a professor, I wouldn't, you know, force something. But there were lots of professors that I thought were interesting or cool or did some kind of interesting research or had some good insight on something. And for those professors, they had office hours and most students never went to them. I would just go to the office hours and I would ask them questions and I would ask them for help. And, you know, I would really show and make them look like the expert because they are. And I'd be interested in what's going on. And then inevitably they would turn the tables around and be interested in whatever I was doing. To me, that's the number one way to start.
All right, Nick. So kind of moving forward with your story here. So you got this internship, you got a job. I'm going to make the assumption that you started with them. Your wife now has a master's. She's a physical therapist. Where are you now? So I'm trying to figure out the math of this, right? Like you're 25. I'm assuming you graduated college 21, 22. How do we get from here to there?
Yeah. So maybe an interesting piece is that my wife and I got married young, like I said earlier. So I was 20 years old when we got married and my wife is 2.5 years older than me. We got married the summer before my senior year of college. And it was the summer before she entered the first year in her graduate program. Our actual first year of marriage, we were both in college and I was working as an intern. And, you know, before you ask, was that a wise financial decision? So we had saved up money at that point and we had what I like to call a burn rate. And we basically knew that we had enough money in savings that between that and the little bit I was making as an intern, we could last until I graduated college, which was about 10 months.
I'm curious because you're in college and you get married in college. So you go from being a dependent where your parents' assets are being looked at with the EFC and the FAFSA and all that stuff to now a married couple in college. Did that change your financial aid equation at all that final year?
It did not because of the scholarship. So I actually ended up having to pay taxes on some of that scholarship money because it gets counted as income once you get over and above the kind of stated cost of tuition. So it didn't change my aid at all.
Cool. So financially, you're in your early 20s. This is not a huge historical look back. This is actually relatively within the last few years. And you have somewhat of an insignificant net worth, which is pretty remarkable. I mean, I had negative six figures by the time that I got out of college. So you're doing great. But right now you have essentially achieved, and this is kind of how we set up the episode, you've achieved most of the benefits that people wait till they reach financial independence to really claim. You're pulling this off now. Like, help us figure out how you and your wife were able to reverse engineer this whole equation.
Yeah. So we get out of college and I take a job that is quote unquote my dream job. This is what I went to college for. This is what, you know, the last 8 years of my life effectively have been leading up to. And my wife is in the middle of her grad program. And pretty soon thereafter, when I actually had time on my hands to slow down and breathe a little bit, I realized that this is not what I wanted to be doing with my life, which is pretty crushing to realize after you've worked so hard to achieve this place. So I started reading online. Now, at this point, I was already into finance. I'd read a few personal finance books in college and high school that I had liked and stumbled across a few blogs. And I came across this blog called Mr. Money Mustache. And all of a sudden, my eyes were open to this idea of, you know, maybe not working as the engineer for my whole career. Now, another side note on this is that I've always been really into teaching. And I used to teach piano lessons and I used to do ACT prep and math tutoring. And so my dream at that point was to go hard after Phi, reach close to Phi, maybe not all the way, and then quit my job and become a high school math teacher. That was the initial game plan. And pretty soon after that, I realized throughout working, this is actually the first time in my life that I had a job that I wasn't in control of. I grew up working for my dad, and then I, you know, sold candy bars in high school, and I sold bread to my neighbors, homemade bread that my mom and I would make. And then I did tutoring and teaching. And then all of a sudden, I had this job where, you know, was more traditional, working at a desk, and I couldn't stand it. And so pretty quickly, I was like, okay, well, even the idea of working 5 to 10 years, getting close to Phi, and then becoming a teacher wasn't appealing because I could already foresee some of my friends who were becoming teachers at that time that I was not going to be happy in the education system either. And luckily, that's when I found out about this world that the internet has opened up and this idea of online work and freelancing and doing work online and teaching online. that was when I was like, okay, what if instead of doing this, I figured out a way to achieve all these things that I care about with FI earlier. That was when I started looking at freelance work and figuring out a way to get out of the day job with other types of income.
I actually have a follow-up question about your financial picture before you guys really took this leap and explored this freelance situation that you're describing. What was yours and your wife's income? What were you guys making?
When I took my internship job, I started out at $15 an hour. Keep in mind, this is kind of Southeast Tennessee, so no state income tax. So it was fantastic money, especially for a college kid. And then when I landed my full-time engineering job, my first year salary was $64,000. Now, it should be noted, because of the type of engineering that I was in, I actually did get paid straight time for overtime, so not time and a half. But I was able to get more money than just my salary. So I think by the end of that first year, we were somewhere around 70 grand.
So you guys are making $70,000, and now you're starting to look for, is there a way that I can realign my income that will give me location independence? And I think at the beginning of the episode, you talked about how your wife already was able to do the equivalent of locum tenens. I think, and if you're a physician, it's probably, it may have a different name if you're in PT, but you're basically able to be a traveling PT and work for 3 to 4, maybe even longer terms in different areas of the country. I know we've had Jared from Fifth Wheel PT also describe a similar situation, and that it's an awesome vehicle. But your current situation, you couldn't do engineering remotely. So when you say freelancing, tell us a little bit more about what you had in mind freelancing, because I would imagine it's going to be a little bit of a challenge on day one to replace close to $60,000 or $70,000 of engineering income.
Yeah, it was absolutely a challenge. And, you know, at this time, my wife still had 2 more years in graduate school. So we were planning to do travel PT, but I had 2 years before we could even really start that. As far as freelance was concerned, that was when I found out that all these kind of online businesses that I was looking at, a lot of the bloggers that all the listeners are totally familiar with, all of those people that are making real money, they have teams. They have teams of contractors behind them that help with the website, that help create content, that help edit and produce podcasts. There's kind of all these different jobs that are around these kind of small media companies. And what I figured out was, what if I could build a skill set that would enable me to be hired by those types of individuals? You know, I launched a blog in August of 2015, partly because I wanted to start teaching my version of personal finance, but also partly because it forced me to learn that new skill set. It took me about 8 or 9 months before I landed my first freelance gig with a freelance writing and then building a few landing pages for websites. But that all started with watching YouTube videos on how to build a website, watching YouTube videos on how to start a blog. And I built up that skill set and then eventually was able to build up a small base of clients and kind of expand out from there.
Nick, when you first thought about doing this freelancing, you're talking about building a skill set, and obviously you've talked about a love for learning and hard work throughout this episode. So I get it. Like, you can learn skills, but what did you envision this looking like? I mean, was it building websites? Was it freelance writing? Like, did you have an end goal in mind at that beginning, or was it just, I'm going to learn enough skills so I'm invaluable to somebody or many somebodies?
Gosh, great question. So yes, my wife and I especially, we're massive long-term planners. So we have like stuff in our life that we haven't even necessarily gotten into as far as what we want our life to look like in 10 and 15 years. And part of that vision is I do want to make an impact in people's lives when it comes to money and help them with money. At this point, I had gotten, kind of become the go-to personal finance guy in my small little friend group and helping us all set up our 401ks at work and understand credit cards out of college. And I loved teaching and I loved helping people in that way. So my long-term goal was to be involved in personal finance, just like what we're doing right now. I knew that I didn't have the experience, the knowledge base, or the skill set to go and do that right this minute. So what I needed to do was get around people who did know all that stuff and learn from them. And the best way that I could learn from them was to build up a skill set that they need and get them to hire me. For instance, now I'm part of the FinCon team, which is what a lot of people listening may or may not know about. But FinCon is just a big media conference for people like you guys, podcasters who talk about money. And one of my freelance clients now is working with that team and getting experience being around those types of people. And that all was because my long-term goal is to help make an impact in personal finance.
I think for our audience, Nick, we have to like put this in perspective. Like, this is not something that happened 5 or 6 years ago. Within like the last maybe 1, 2, or 3 years, you left your engineering job. And just, I'm putting our audience in that position. You're in your last day of work or last week or so of work. You're telling your coworkers, all right, guys, I'm heading out on the road. We're going to be in the Airstream. We're traveling around the country. And you got the one guy there that's been waiting to do, make this exact same move for 20 or 30 years until. What gave you the confidence to say, okay, we've officially hit the spot that we can pull this off? Had you replaced your engineering income? Did you have a significant net worth? Help us figure out how this was possible.
You know, honestly, there's no way I can say how this was possible without talking about my wife, because I really do feel like I hit the lottery in terms of who she is as a person and her help and our kind of strategic focus together. When she graduated, she took a job as a travel PT immediately, and I quit my job. So I left on a Friday. She started on a Monday, and her income was effectively around 70 grand. So we basically just swapped and kind of high-fived as one of us became, you know, the main breadwinner. And then she was like, all right, I got this. That allowed me to go all in with the freelance clients and really spend my time really building that up. And then 8 months after that, is when Hannah left her job as a physical therapist, because the freelance basis was growing. I needed more help, and we didn't want to be stuck in one location for 3 months at a time, wherever her company sent us. And so she was like, hey, you know, let's start working together. So she left and started working with me full time. That was about a year ago. So as far as the confidence, I mean, honestly, it was a mixture of income. So we had effectively replaced our income with just new income. So that felt good. And then the big thing was, we both know and rely on each other and trust each other and have a deep amount of trust that both of us are hard workers. And if everything went to crap, if everything broke tomorrow, we both still have really hireable degrees and we could go get jobs doing exactly what we used to be doing with almost no pain at all. So to me, it was all upside. It was like, why not go and jump and take this leap? We've built a safety net with careers, with relationships in those careers, and with new careers. Like this to us became a no-brainer.
Okay, I have a bunch of questions, but I'll start here. So obviously I get it that your wife started as the traveling physical therapist while you're building up the business, but then you reach this inflection point, I guess, where what you're doing is growing, right? Because it got to the point where she left her PT job to come and work on what is now the family business. Talk us through like that decision, because that's not so easy to really go full time as a set of entrepreneurs. Did she enjoy being a PT? Like, I mean, was this something that was a hardship? Like, is that a difficult conversation for you guys as a couple?
Yeah, it was real hard. It was very hard. And to be honest, like Hannah still struggles some today with like the identity piece, because we both had built up our lives around these careers and she identified as a physical therapist. And so leaving that felt like, you know, who am I? So that's been real tough, especially for her. As far as the conversation, she did enjoy aspects of her physical therapy job, but there were a lot of aspects that she didn't enjoy and that really were draining. A lot of that has to do, without getting, you know, way into the weeds here, a lot of that has to do with just the medical system in general right now and how tough it can be on people that are having to work in it and trying to provide care for people in the best way possible. So part of that was a struggle. And then part of it was just the freedom. We live in a travel trailer, but we were still limited on mobility. If she came to work with me, then we could go anywhere, anytime. And the other part of that is the very real kind of life smack you in the face part, which is over the last year and a half, we've had a couple of family members that have really needed help from a health standpoint. So we've actually limited some of our travel and are limiting it right now pretty significantly to be around family and help them out on a daily basis, because that's a big priority of ours. That's a huge value in our life. Had she not left her job and I not left my job, you know, the town we're currently in is a very rural town. There's not a lot of people here. There's not a lot of jobs here. I certainly could not do what I used to do here. And even she might have a difficult job, you know, finding a job close. And so that's another big benefit. And another thing that we saw was we want to spend time with our family members, especially the ones that may not be with us forever. So that was a big driver in the conversation as well.
So Nick, you're obviously talking about priorities and values in life. Clearly, you guys prioritize family. And it's wonderful that you have the flexibility to be able to do that. And you said before, a quote, all these things I care about, like when you're talking about making that decision to leave your jobs and pursue all of these things I care about. And I'm curious if you've had time to internalize and really think about your values and what you want your life to look like and how this newfound life that you guys have taken and chosen, how that helps you get there.
Yeah, that's a huge part of the conversation. It's a huge part of what we talk about on honestly a daily basis. So for us, a couple of big things is that in our old jobs, we spend a lot of time looking around at the people that were in the career paths that were 20 and 30 years ahead of us, looking at their life and going, that's not the life that we want. And that was very eye-opening right out of college. And then that led us to going, okay, well, what is the life that we want? You know, if that's not it, what does that look like? And for us, when we really sat down and thought about it, relationships with our loved ones is top priority. Then we started talking about our future family. And this kind of gets into another conversation around we feel very strong about adopting kids in the future and possibly kids who have special needs. And a lot of that plays into my wife's physical therapy background and actually me growing up around some kids with special needs. And so we feel strongly about those sorts of things. Another big desire for us is we feel very strongly about having pets, and pets are very big in our life. And so having four pets in an apartment was a no-no, but four pets in our Airstream, we can do that. So we made a list of all kind of these big values in our life. And that's when we started looking and say, okay, how can we start working towards these values now? Some of the values we've already got, like the freedom and flexibility, the doing meaningful work, which is a huge priority for us, feeling like I'm doing things that make an impact. We have those things. The pets, we have those things. The adoption piece, the other family pieces, those are things that are going to come over the course of the next 5 to 10 years. And what we know is we have, you know, estimated amounts of money that we want set aside for that to feel safe and secure before we make those decisions. We have estimated other goals around, like, do we want to own a house by then? Do we want to actually, you know, have rental property by then is one thing we're looking at. So we kind of have a lot of different ideas of ways that we would like to prepare for some of these bigger things. And what our life right now does is it gives us the extreme flexibility to both control our spending, because travel full time is very controllable. It's not cheap necessarily, but you can do it cheaper if you travel slower and control what you're doing. And then income, we are able to work for our own and scale up income a lot quicker than we could in a traditional career path. That's the ideal anyways, which is also going to help us, you know, set up for some of those future big priorities.
Yeah, Nick, that's amazing. As you're describing this, I'm just like feeling this integrated team that you and your wife are. How do you guys talk about this? So many couples out there struggle to talk about finances, to talk about the big things in life. And it seems like you guys have hit on it. What does this practically look like on a weekly, monthly, yearly basis?
Man, that's hard. The first couple of years of our marriage, even though we were quote unquote a good team in some ways, and they were tough. And we actually really struggled to get on the same page, especially financially, for the first couple of years and having different priorities. The thing that really worked for us was trying extremely hard to have empathy for the other person and just simply put ourselves in their shoes. So what I like to do is the way we started is by dreaming on, let's say, not that important of things, like lower depth topics, like where would you like to travel one day and getting a dog and, you know, kind of all these just big life goals. And we didn't talk about money at all. I tried to make it a daily and weekly habit over dinner when we're in the car together to just dream. Hey, if you were going to have a house, what kind of house would you want? A lot of land, a little land, flat yard, hilly yard. We just talked about all kinds of stuff in the future. Naturally, as you do that, the conversations get deeper and deeper, which is where you start talking about kids and adoption and, you know, some of those more harder topics that are way bigger decisions to make and dreaming about jobs. So I tried to make it, and she did too, try to make it a weekly habit of just dreaming together. And eventually, if you do that long enough, you naturally, one of you will go, okay, we've been dreaming about this for a long time. Like, let's actually do something about it. What would it take for us to get a dog? What would it take for us to go take that trip that you really want? And that's when you can start opening up the conversation around finance and say, okay. And honestly, that is our story. We were not on the same page until I finally came around and said, okay, you want a dog really badly. Like, let's map it out. Let's get a dog. Let's map out the expenses. Let's map out what it's going to take to do that. And then she was like, okay, I'm on board. Like, let's budget. Let's rock and roll. Like, let's get on the same page. Because at that point, she was willing to sacrifice a lot to get the dog. After we were able to do that and get our first dog, that just kind of got the snowball rolling in terms of, oh, wow, if we dream together and then work together, we can accomplish way more. We love Chip and Joanna Gaines and Chip Gaines has this line in his book where he says, things got way easier when me and Joanna got on the same side of the rope and started pulling together in the same direction rather than trying to pull against each other. And that was definitely part of our story.
Yeah, Nick, I absolutely love that. That dreaming together and what would it take for us to get ... It reminds me of something I read way back when in the 4-Hour Workweek. I think Tim Ferriss called it dreamlining. And it was exactly that. It was setting concrete goals for what seems like dreams. But when you actually break it down into a stepwise process, it's not that hard. It's not that unimaginable. There are ways to get there. I love that you actually practically did that. That's super cool.
I have kind of an alternate line of questioning for you, and it's a little bit of a pivot here, but I'm curious, your income is now being derived in large part due to something that I hear referenced in the mainstream as the gig economy. And I sometimes hear this with a negative connotation because it's going to put more onus back on the individual, I guess, contractors in this case, or freelancers. And I'm curious in your mind, because it sounds like it's been such a source of, I guess, a blessing for your family and your freedom. Is it good? Is it bad? What are the pros and the cons for listeners that really haven't considered it and they're still like nose down in the traditional college path? And if they suddenly are like, all right, well, maybe I should explore this further, what advice would you give?
Whew. Yeah, that's a loaded question. I think there's two ways to look at the world, just in general frameworks. I think you can inherently look at the world in a negative way with the change, or you can look at the world in a positive way. Are there negatives because of the economy? Yes, 100%. No doubt there are negatives that come along with it. Just like whenever there's any change in the whole history of the world, there's negatives that come along with it. But there's also a lot of positives. My grandparents, I could tell, were happy for us, but almost a little jealous or a little sad that they never got the opportunity to do what we are doing because the internet didn't exist when we jumped into our Airstream and took off. As a general rule of thumb, I try really hard to take a look at the positive. And to me, the gig economy has provided a ton of benefits. And so what Hannah and I try really hard to do is rather than dwelling on the past, the way things used to be, that's just not very practical. Like there's nothing I can do about that. My father-in-law has worked at the exact same company since he was like 20 years old, and he's been there for close to 40 years. That's just not the way life works anymore for my generation. And we took a look at that and said, okay, like that's just the way it is. Now, how can we take advantage of the way things are to really live the best life possible? So I think for us, it's a certain mindset and a skew. I think there's positives and negatives, just like there are to most things. I just choose to focus on the positives.
I love that, man. I mean, essentially, is the glass empty or half full? I don't know, but there's wine in it, so we're okay.
Exactly.
All right. I want to take what you did with the scholarships and what you did with the internships, and I want to apply that mental framework to someone that is considering embracing this idea of the gig economy. What can someone do to set themselves up to thrive if this is the new reality? And I believe that it is.
I think the number one thing anybody can do, which sounds like a gimmicky answer, but I'm serious here, is to spend some real time on self-awareness. That means taking personality tests. That means taking StrengthsFinder tests. Figure out what you're good at and what you excel at. And then try and map that as best as possible to jobs that are in the gig economy. As an example, I knew just from a self-awareness piece that I'm a strong learner and I can teach myself just about anything given enough time. I also knew that I'm extremely left-brain, tech-oriented, and math-oriented. So the back end of creating a website and doing kind of the technical marketing side of things, I could figure that stuff out. So what I spend a lot of time doing is knowing my strengths and then looking at websites of companies that I like. So I went to FinCon's website and all these other financial sites that I liked, and I would just click on the careers tab or the jobs tab, figure out what kind of jobs they were looking for, and then try and map that to a skill set that I could then learn and apply. To me, self-awareness, figuring out your strengths, and then leaning into that is hands down the number one thing. And kind of on that note, another strength of mine is building relationships with people in person. I spent a lot of time, especially during the first few years, going to events where I knew the types of people that I wanted to hire me were going to be, and I would build relationships there with them. I did send out a lot of cold pitch emails, but I was never really successful with that. I think going back to my writing strengths not being the best, but I could do well in person. So that's where I spent my time and energy. And inevitably, when I would go to a conference, I would come back and have landed at least one new freelance client.
So what I love about your story, Nick, is that this is not a conversation about how far you are on the path to FI. Very pointedly, we are observing the fact that you have designed the future that you wanted for your financially independent self, and you're living it now. I can't stress that enough. And so I think where I want to circle back to with our audience is, if someone's listening to this and they want to replicate that, what final thoughts would you give to that individual on designing a future they can get excited about now?
You know, honestly, the way I think about it is, break it down really nice and easy. Figure out, why are you listening to this podcast right now? Like, why are you trying to get to financial independence? Map that out. Is it freedom? Is it flexibility? Is it time with family? Is it meaningful work? What is it? And then the next thing is, figure out, okay, is there a way that you can get like maybe one, two, or three of those things, kind of the bulk of them, sooner rather than later by doing something different, by making some big changes? Maybe that means changing where you live, moving cities. Maybe it means finding a new job. But I would venture a guess that the vast majority of us, if we really spent some introspective time, could achieve some of those main benefits much sooner than having to wait to achieve FI. And for us, you know, like, I'm not saying don't neglect FI. We're still saving. We're still, you know, we're looking at buying a rental property next year and trying to, you know, maintain and build wealth. But our FI, you know, the FI faster, that's not our story. We're looking to hit FI hopefully by 50 and do meaningful work along the way. Still plan for it, but I want to enjoy the journey along the way.
Wow, Nick, I love your story and I love this life that you've created for yourself. If people want to connect with you and connect with your content, what is the best way for someone to find out more about what you're doing?
Yeah, the best thing to do is probably just go to YouTube and type in Mapped Out Money or type in Nick True, and that'll pull up our channel. We do have a website, mappedoutmoney.com, but YouTube's definitely our home base.
All right, now on most shows, that would be the end of the episode. But on this show, Nick, we would love to give you the chance to tackle the hot seat. Are you ready for this?
I'm so ready.
In a world drowning in debt and rampant consumption, trapped by the chains of lifestyle inflation, these questions highlight the secrets of those who have broken free. Welcome to the Choose FI Hot Seat.
All right, Nick, question number one, your favorite blog that's not your own.
Definitely Wait But Why. It's my most favorite blog on the internet ever. If I had to give a finance one, it would be Afford Anything by Paula Pant, who coincidentally is also a massive Wait But Why fan.
She is indeed. Any particular articles jump out we can put in the show notes?
Yeah, my favorite one on Wait But Why would be The Tail End, which is all about kind of the last days. And he goes through and starts off with, I only have this many years left in my life, so this is the number of times I'm probably going to eat tacos. And he like draws up graphs, and it starts off light. And then by the end, he's talking about the number of times he has left with his parents. And you're just like, ooh, and it really hits you in the gut and makes you think a lot.
Yeah, I think my wife looked at those boxes and determined that I had run out of boxes for Taco Bell. I don't know.
Oh. It's
All right. Question number two, your favorite article of all time. Now, this can be one that you wrote or someone else's.
Paula Pant's article on Minding the Gap, where she really lays out like, look, let's be frugal, let's minimize our expenses, but let's also not neglect income and getting that gap as wide as possible. I just like that two-pronged approach. I think sometimes in personal finance, we lean too heavy to one way or the other. And I really like her perspective on both.
Completely agree. And it is a fantastic article.
All right. Question number three, your favorite life hack.
So recently I have been tracking and budgeting my time, just like I have my money for the last, you know, however long. And I don't know why it just dawned on me a couple months ago when I read a book about this. And I was like, huh, yeah, I should probably be budgeting my time just like I budget my money. So the last 2 months have been great in terms of just productivity and making sure I'm really using my time in the best way possible for my day. So that's my favorite thing right now.
You know what's funny about that? I think Brad breaks out into cold sweats as a former accountant anytime he hears the word tracking your time. But for me, I have a little bit of trouble really focusing on Choose FI related work in an efficient manner. So I find that by not necessarily with my leisure time, but with my work time, with when I'm trying to edit a podcast or do anything like that, it does help me just to keep an eye on how much I'm actually putting into something. And I found that useful as well. So I can't say that my time tracker encompasses all 24 hours a day, but it does give me a pretty good sense of how much time I'm putting into a work-related project.
So Nick, I'm actually curious, like on a practical basis, like what this budgeting time looks like. Like, are you talking about batching and doing that kind of thing? Or is it just merely by tracking, you get a better sense of of where your time is, and then you can look at priorities.
Yeah, so just like budgeting with money, I always tell people to start with tracking and then we can move into budgeting later. So when I first started, I was using an app. It's a free tool online called Toggle. And I would just hit that every time I was switching to a new task and, you know, let that kind of rack up. And I would even track, like, if I get sucked into a YouTube spiral, I would go back and edit and be like, okay, I got sucked into YouTube for 45 minutes. And so I would just track. And then over time, I've started using Toggle in conjunction with my Google Calendar to try and create those batch blocks and really be more efficient. So it's kind of a combo now.
So I use Toggle as well, but I haven't made the bridge. I'll have to like pick your brain on how to implement the Google Calendar into that.
Yeah, that sounds good.
All right. Question number four, your biggest financial mistake.
My biggest one would be letting unexpected expenses control me. We've had a lot of fights in our marriage that the root of the issue has been something unexpected happened in our budget and I freaked out. And I'm a massive planner and I don't like unplanned things. So that was definitely the biggest, is really letting those things railroad me and just let my emotions take over. To compensate for that these days, one, I've just learned that, hey, you know what? Life is unexpected sometimes, and to take a chill pill. And then the second thing is, from a practical standpoint, we work in a nice, healthy, unexpected expenses category monthly so that it makes me feel at ease whenever something does come up.
Sounds like you're saying your biggest financial mistake is not discovering the chill pill sooner.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right.
I read a really interesting article on your site, actually, about financial health and how you kind of maybe ruin your entire honeymoon because of this.
Yeah. Yeah, that's exactly right. We fought for 3 days straight on our cruise. And I used to be very embarrassed to tell this story because it, you know, just makes me look like a complete jerk, which I was. But long story short, I didn't realize that cruises come along with a lot of expenses. It's not a one and done kind of thing. And so we got on the boat and all of a sudden we had all these extra things going on and I freaked. And, you know, we're early in our marriage. I'm 20 years old. You know, we don't have that much money. And so a couple hundred bucks for a few extra things, you know, did feel like a lot. I let that control me and I let that, you know, go into fun suck, Nick. And man, the next 3 days were pretty miserable. We fought the whole time. And I look back on that. I'm not proud of that time, but we learned a lot and our marriage is a lot stronger now because of it.
I feel like fun suck, Nick is like a meme that will forever live on the internet somewhere. I don't know. I'm going to look for it after this episode. All right. Question number five, the advice you would give your younger self.
Yeah. So this actually kind of goes along with that, which is learning empathy and selflessness earlier. So in high school, especially, I was really black and white and had almost no empathy for anyone ever. It was very hard-nosed. And then when I read that book, How to Win Friends and Influence People, I really started learning the value of empathy and putting myself in other people's shoes. And obviously, that's been a major part of our marriage, is trying to understand each other. So, man, if I could get people to understand empathy as early as possible, that'd be the best.
I tell you, I read that book that you've talked about a decade ago, but just because of this episode, I'm thinking I need to go check it out from the library again.
All right, Nick, we've got a bonus question for you. What's the purchase that you've made in, let's say, the last 12 months or so that's added the most value to your life?
Ooh, definitely my Peak Design backpack. So this is like, I don't know, I think it's a luxury. It's like a $300 backpack. So it's way more than I would normally spend. But I looked at this thing for close to 6 months, planned on it, you know, was really excited about it, saved up for it. It's a camera bag / laptop bag. It's just fantastic. I love it. I'm all about it. And it's definitely brought me the biggest joy and practical use.
Awesome. Nick, thanks so much for coming on the show today, sharing your story with us. We have just had an absolutely fantastic time.
Yeah. Thanks so much for having me on. It's been a blast to talk to you guys.
If you got value from today's episode, and if you've been getting value from the episodes up to this point, just take 1 second and press the subscribe button on the platform you're listening to this on. It just lets the providers know you're getting value from the show and you want to be here when we produce additional content. If you want to support us in what we're doing here at ChooseFI, here are 4 easy ways. 1, leave us an iTunes review. To do that, just go to choosefi.com/iTunes. 2, use our page to sign up for travel credit cards. If you want to travel the world with miles and points instead of your hard-earned dollars, then just go to choosefi.com/cards and get started today. 3, if you're working on the milestones of FI, set up a personal capital account to track your progress and use our affiliate link. It's completely free and just go to choosefi.com/PC. P as in Paul, C as in cat. And 4, and most importantly, find your friends, coworkers, and family members who might be open to this message and tell them about the podcast. Have them start with episode 100. It is a fantastic starting place. All right, my friends, the fire is spreading. We'll see you next time as we continue to go down the road less traveled.
You've been listening to Choose FI Radio Podcast, where we help middle-class America build wealth, one life hack at a time.